Last summer, Illinois decided to overhaul the way it funds public schools, but on Monday, Governor Rauner vetoed a key part of that plan because he said the state needs to do more for private schools. State Senator Andy Menar joins us to explain why he believes this new political fight will block equitable school funding for everyone else.
It's going to be highly unlikely that any new money will be distributed to schools in an equitable fashion this fiscal year.
Plus, with more than 4,000 companies trying to outshine the rest at this year's Consumer Electronics Show, we hear from Chicago startups like MotoBag.
Hi, my name's Kevin, and I'm the inventor of MotoBag. My team and I put together this great new product that's going to change the way the world travels.
But first, WBEZ's Natalie Moore learned that one of her books is banned in New Jersey prisons, and she's not the only one. We'll hear from her and the John Howard Association about banned books. Stay tuned. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The U.S. has had prison libraries for almost as long as our country has existed, and even though prisoners don't have very many options in terms of their leisure time, books in prison can be an important resource, both while people are incarcerated and afterwards. Not all books are allowed in prison libraries. There are more restrictions on prison libraries than your typical public libraries, you can imagine, and in Texas prisons, about 10,000 books are banned. Earlier this week, New Jersey made headlines for banning a very influential book on mass incarceration. That's Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. This made news after the ACLU of New Jersey got its hand on a list of banned books in state prisons there. One of those books was co-written by a journalist here in Illinois. WBEZ Chicago Public Media reporter Natalie Moore discovered one of her books was on the list. It's the almighty Black Peacestone Nation, The Rise and Fall of an American Gang. Natalie is on the line with us right now from Chicago. Hey, Natalie, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla.
So, Natalie, how did you first learn that the book that you, the almighty Black Peacestone Nation, how did you first learn that it was banned?
I found out via Twitter, and I found out from Natalie Hopkinson, who I co-wrote my first book with, and she said, hey, she tweeted a list that the ACLU of New Jersey did a Freedom of Information request to the New Jersey Department of Corrections asking for their list of banned books, publications. And then it's a very extensive list, a very odd list, like Wine Spectator is on there, Popular Science was on there, The Art of War was on there, and then, lo and behold, Almighty Black Peacestone Nation.
So, if people can't tell from your title, your book that you wrote is about the history of one of Chicago's probably most famous or infamous street organizations, the Blackstone Rangers. Can you explain a little bit more to our listeners about the book?
Sure. So the subtitle of the book is The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. The Blackstone started on the south side of Chicago in the Woodlawn neighborhood in the 1960s. And the book is really a social history. There are three major policies, federal policies, that intersected with the organization, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism. The gang got money in the 1960s through a church in Chicago to fight poverty. And then when the war on drugs was launched in the 1970s, Reagan in the early 1980s decided to use RICO laws to hit street organizations when at that time they were only being used for the mob. And then finally, when the gang became the El Rukins, they were the first Americans convicted of domestic terrorism in the United States, and that was for a relationship that they had with Gaddafi, the former head of Libya.
And so you detail in the book about Jeff Fort being the first person ever convicted of domestic terrorism. He is in solitary confinement in Colorado, right, Natalie? Do you think that's why the book is banned? It's kind of hard, I guess, to figure out why.
I have not talked to the folks there. There are a number of books on that list that might suggest, you know, so-called street literature. That would be novels, fiction about, you know, urban life, and that could be gangs, it could be crime. The list was so long that I have a hard time believing that this was a list that was truly vetted.
Right, because I don't think Wine Spectator magazine falls into street literature, right?
Right. I don't know if it's because it's alcohol. Like, there's so many questions. And I think that there was probably an assumption made, oh, well, this book is about the gang. And gang members populate our prisons. And therefore, we don't want them to get any ideas. So we're going to ban this book.
How did it make you feel hearing that your book was banned in a prison?
Well, I have a number of friends that you're in great company. If you look at, Michelle Alexander being on that list, I can't say that I was 100% surprised. I think that there increasingly seems to be curtailments on what people can read in prison. I just finished reading Danielle Allen's book, Cuz. And that's a book, she used to be a professor at the University of Chicago, and it's about her cousin who was in prison. And so it's a family story, but she talks about at one point she wanted him to get a degree from University of Indiana, but he couldn't take the classes because the type of textbook was banned from prison. So I was aware that not everything gets in through prison. And then New York Department of Corrections, just this week, I've seen some stories about how they're curtailing what books are donated. And we're talking about books in prisons, and it goes to this idea that our prisons are no longer really places where there's rehabilitation going on. And when you start curtailing things like books, and books don't always have to be about getting a degree or getting education. Books, like, you're in prison, you want to read. It can be entertainment. It can, you know, there are many different reasons to get pleasure out of reading.
That's WBEZ Chicago's Natalie Moore. She's also an author. This is one of her books that she co-wrote, The Almighty Black Peacestone Nation, The Rise, Fall, Resurgence of an American Gang. Natalie, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I should point out to our audience, the ACLU of New Jersey has taken action on this. Yesterday, they tweeted out that the State Department of Corrections there has lifted the ban on Michelle Alexander's book. I'm joined now by Jenny Volen-Katz. She's the executive director of the John Howard Association. They're a nonpartisan prison watchdog group that's based in Chicago. Hi, Jenny. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Jenny, to Natalie's point about how people in prison read and sort of the whole notion of how we're looking at prison systems, whether there are, even the whole point of whether or not they're rehabilitative or not. Let me just ask you about sort of whether or not most prisons in Illinois, do they have their own libraries, or is it just some prisons in Illinois that have libraries?
So they do have libraries, but in 2002, so there are law libraries, and then there are libraries for other kinds of reading, for non-legal materials. Having a law library in a prison is something they have to do under federal law. Having the other kind of library for non-legal materials is really is optional. And in Illinois in 2002, the line item budget item that funded that was taken away. So it's really been a struggle to get books, new books, into Illinois prisons.
We did reach out to the Illinois Department of Corrections. They did tell us their statewide librarian has been out all week because we were trying to get a response about how Illinois makes decisions about which books are allowed and which books are banned. But Jenny, I wanted to ask you a little bit about if you can maybe help us understand what goes into the thinking behind this. Obviously, I think we all understand that prisons are not democracies. And Texas banning, for example, a pop-up edition of A Charlie Brown Christmas makes sense. There's no need for adults to have pop-up books. You can hide contraband in it. But other things like banning Freakonomics or The Color Purple, while books by white nationalists like David Duke or Mein Kampf, like, that's okay. So it makes me wonder, who decides which books are allowed and which ones get banned?
Well, that's a really good question, and you are not the only person asking that question. So one of the problems is, you know, first of all, every state does it differently. And then in Illinois, pretty much every facility does it differently. So there is one overarching guideline, an administrative directive that spells out, you know, in broad terms what's to be considered. And it basically establishes that each facility should have a publications review committee, and that committee is charged with reviewing the various publications and books to determine whether or not they're appropriate to be inside a prison. And I think the complicated part comes next, which is the guidelines are so broad and so, you know, can be interpreted in so many different ways that you get the kind of results that you just spoke about when you pointed out what books, you know, have traditionally come in and have not come in, and it's really hard to understand what the reasoning would have been for those decisions. And so I think that a big part of the problem is that the criteria is overly broad. It's also not made public. So there, you know, people don't really understand what the guidelines are. There's very little transparency around this. There's also very little opportunity for input beyond this publications review committee. And by the way, you don't necessarily know who's on that committee in each prison.
What reasons do you think prison systems have for restricting access to certain books, Jenny?
So, I mean, certainly, as you point out, there are legitimate safety concerns that have to be taken into account when deciding what, you know, anything that can and cannot come into a prison. However, you know, the way almost every policy is written when it comes to, you know, a Department of Corrections, state agency, the prisons they run, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, you know, there's almost always some language about preserving the safety and security of the institution. And it is that phrase that allows prisons to make a lot of decisions that a lot of us question with very little reason being given. So under that, you know, that, and that extends to pretty much every decision, every policy that is made in a carceral setting. So, for instance, in Illinois, some of the articulated reasons that a publication would not be allowed into a facility would be that the material is obscene, with very little definition given to that, that it encourages hatred, that it encourages commission of a crime, that the material is detrimental to security or rehabilitation, discipline, or order within the prison. Those are really, I mean, under just using that kind of language, you could pretty much come up with a reason to ban anything. So it's, And I think the directives and the policies are written to give prisons that kind of authority and that kind of flexibility in decision making. And it can be really detrimental to the incarcerated population. You know, we want to encourage them to read, to grow, to be interested in education, to do things that will allow for change. You know,
yeah,
we want
Jenny,
to promote rehabilitation.
I wanted to ask you about that too. How important are books in prisons for prisoners? How often are they used?
Oh, I think they're very important. I think they are, you know, first of all, they provide an escape. They provide an activity, you know, let alone the opportunities for education, you know, just promoting, I mean, you know, reading leads to pro-social and positive changes. In fact, there's an organization in Illinois, they're called the 3 R's, and those R's stand for Reading Reduces Recidivism. And, you know, they point towards research and articles that show, you know, that there are real positive impacts that come from supporting and encouraging inmates to read.
So in your mind, ideally, what would it look like, a list of what literature should be allowed in prisons from the perspective of the John Howard Association?
Right. Well, first of all, I think that the Publications Review Committee, you know, should be transparent. And I think any list of criteria or list of specific books or publications that can't come in should be made public. I think that VATLA should be open to scrutiny. I think that they should take input from inmates, from the loved ones of incarcerated individuals, from other stakeholders. You know, ideally, your publications review committee would include some sort of external input so that there is other information coming into that committee so that the consideration could be based on broader factors and perspectives. So I think, you know, I think also taking into consideration the viewpoint of people in the profession like librarians would be very helpful. You know, we hear stories all the time in our youth facilities in Illinois about, you know, books that receive national awards that the facilities will say, no, can't come in. And, you know, I think there has to be a balance. You know, safety definitely has to be at the forefront of the minds of correctional professionals. On the other hand, there has to be room to consider some of these other books and publications and the benefits that they bring to an incarcerated population. And so I think a more balanced process and a more transparent process might yield better results for everybody.
Jenny, we just have about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you, we mentioned about New Jersey and the ACLU getting involved. Are there legal options for groups or individuals in Illinois who want to challenge bans?
You know, I don't really know. I mean, there are certainly internal processes for filing grievances and pursuing them. In terms of legal options, I think it would look a lot like what it does in New Jersey. And frankly, in Illinois, I wouldn't be surprised if the organization counted on to pursue this kind of legal remedy wasn't the ACLU.
Right.
Of Illinois.
So there was, and the New Jersey ACLU got the information from the banned books list through a FOIA. So just kind of interesting to note that. I want to thank Jenny Volen-Katz. She's executive director of the John Howard Association. They're a prison watchdog group for Illinois based in Chicago. Jenny, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay tuned. We're going to be talking about Governor Rauner's veto of the school funding bill, the historic school funding reform that happened earlier this week. State Senator Andy Menar joins me next. This is the 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. You may remember that last summer, members of our state government agreed to overhaul the way Illinois funds its public schools. You might also remember it took them so long that the state was late on payments to public schools for the very first time. It was a historic reform that was lauded at the time as helping put Illinois schools on a much more equitable funding formula, bringing Illinois up to standards that other states have had for a long time. It turns out the story isn't over. On Monday, Governor Rauner vetoed a bill that would have paved the way for the state to implement this new school funding formula. In a letter, he told lawmakers he wants to change the standard of how private schools are recognized by the state. That recognition determines which schools can receive the $75 million scholarship tax credit we've been talking about on the 21st. If this bill gets stopped dead in its tracks, public schools might not get the amount of money guaranteed by the new formula this fiscal year. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to some schools directly about this issue. But first, State Senator Andy Menar is with us on the line. He's a Democrat who represents Illinois' 48th district, which includes Springfield and Decatur, among other things. He's based in Bunker Hill and, of course, the author, one of the driving forces behind the school funding formula being changed to begin with. Senator Menar, welcome back to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on the show.
So the details of this can get a little technical. So I wanted to start by just asking you about the bill that the governor vetoed. What was it supposed to do and how was it related to the big funding overhaul that became law last year?
Well, it's not uncommon for small pieces of legislation, let alone ones that encompass 500 pages of text that took 5 years to pass, to have what we call a technical trailer bill or a cleanup bill to literally make sure punctuation is correct and make sure that the agency in state government that is in charge of interpreting and enacting the bill does it exactly as the legislature, and in this case the governor with his signature, intended. The State Board of Education, under Governor Rauner's authority, came to the legislature back in October and said, we need a very small set of changes. I think it was about four in total. One literally dealt with the placement of a comma in a sentence. We need you, legislature, to pass this bill so that we can execute and put into motion the much-heralded reform bill so that schools can see its benefit immediately. So the legislature, in the interest of bipartisan cooperation on school funding, passed the bill almost immediately to Governor Rauner, and the governor then sat on it for 60 days up until this week. So it's not unusual. It seems a bit obscure, but I would boil it down to technical corrections to make sure that the law that was passed is implemented the correct way.
And so I should note the bill passed unanimously in the House, passed 42-11 in the Senate. This was a big political fight last year, Senator, just getting all of this funding formula worked out. You worked very closely, I know, with your Republican counterparts as well. I imagine, did you think this was done? What was your reaction when you heard about the governor's veto on Monday?
Well, I began to question the governor's motivation about a month ago, because there was no reason that I could come up with why the governor shouldn't have signed that technical bill immediately after it was sent. After all, he asked for it. And, despite some hesitation on the part of many in the legislature because of the lack of trust that exists between both parties in the General Assembly and the governor, we decided as a group that we should continue to go down the bipartisan path on school funding reform. And if the State Board of Education and the Rauner administration say that they need four or five very small technical cleanups in the law in order to implement the law that we are all celebrating today, then we ought to do that. So we did that immediately. And so when the governor didn't sign that bill right away, I began to quietly ask questions, not, set the world on fire, but ask questions as to why the governor wasn't acting on the bill that he was asking the legislature for. So come this week, I was not all that surprised when the governor took another unconstitutional step, in my opinion, as the executive in the state, and rewrote a very technical bill into a very controversial one, which is not only, in my opinion, unconstitutional, it sets us on the wrong path. It feels today like it felt last summer, which was uncertainty, partisan division. And it literally, in my mind, has erased all of the goodwill that was built over the last several months on the toughest of issues in Illinois, on school funding reform.
So we did reach out. I should note to our audience, we did reach out to Governor Rauner's office. He was not able to come on the program today. His office pointed us to the letter that he sent to the assembly. His spokespeople for him have been quoted in other news outlets, particularly in the Tribune, saying that it's unfair to say this mandatory veto would delay schools from getting money through the new funding formula. Senator Menar, I wonder what your response is to that. Can you explain what you think about the impact of this veto?
Well, let me tell you what's unfair. What is unfair is our system of funding in Illinois that hasn't changed at all, despite the fact that the governor's taking credit for it on television every day. We have the most unfair system in the country, and there hasn't been a single penny that has been distributed under the new system. While many think the money is flowing, it is not. And the governor's veto this week will delay that process even more than it's already been delayed. So, throwing words like unfair around get us back again to the same position we were in over the summer, where there was partisan bickering about school funding. We struck a compromise, a classic compromise that I think produced a good result for the people of the state and for the school districts in the state. And it's unfortunate that a disagreement within the Rauner administration, and I should be clear about that, Nyla, that this is a disagreement within the Rauner administration about which non-public schools should get funding. So he took his position and inserted it into a bill that will delay and hold hostage funding for public schools. That's just flat out wrong in my book.
So you think the governor in this letter he sent to you all said he wants to change the standards for how non-public schools are recognized by the Illinois State Board of Education. He wants to change the eligibility mandates for how essentially the ISBE recognizes private schools, which I imagine then would be whether or not they qualify for this tax credit. Do you have an objection specifically to what he says in this letter?
I have some initial objections, but I will say this, in the interest of fairness, that is a legitimate issue that deserves a debate. And both sides of that argument within the Rauner administration, mind you, should be able to make their case for perhaps an appropriate change in law. But that hasn't happened.
And did that happen, Senator Rauner, did this objection come up when you all were debating the bill, when you were discussing with the governors?
It never came up. And I would also say, and I don't speak for all of the organizations that were proponents of the tax credit language in the final compromise bill, but there is not unanimous agreement within that community about the governor's proposal. There are many that have called me and said, you know what, we don't want to change the criteria because we want the highest standards for these tax credits so that when the sunset period comes up in 5 years, we can come to the legislature and credibly ask for a renewal of the program. I think that's a pretty smart way to go. So again, this is a disagreement within the Rauner administration and his own state board of education, injecting that into a very obscure bill that would set into motion the new formula was the wrong path to take for the governor.
Last question for you, Senator Menard. What happens next? Do you think you all have the votes to override Governor Rauner's mandatory veto?
I frankly think that's going to be very difficult because the nature of this veto, the manner in which it was done, the timing behind it, and the issues that surround both the tax credit piece of the bill as well as the timing of distribution of new formula monies to the most underfunded school districts in the state, I think that is a recipe for more delay and more of an action. I think the governor's veto is so mistaken and so poorly thought out that it's going to threaten any new money going out the door this school year to school districts, which is a promise broken once again to public schools. The one thing I've heard from superintendents across the state more than anything is that what we accomplished back late summer when we struck a bipartisan agreement, isn't that nice in Springfield, a bipartisan agreement, is that we injected certainty into the system for the first time in decades. With the governor's veto, he has completely erased that level of certainty, and we're back into a situation where school districts can't plan budgets, where superintendents don't know what type of financial hurdles they're going to face a month from now or 2 months from now. And that is something that we shouldn't return to. But unfortunately, with the governor's veto, that's where we're at today.
State Senator Andy Menard, a Democrat representing Illinois' 48th District. Thanks, Senator Menard.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk to some districts about how this is going to affect them. Let's go to Kristen Humphreys. He's a superintendent of the East Moline School District. I want to introduce as well Heather Berhalter. She's the director of community development at the Urban Prairie Waldorf Private School in Chicago. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Superintendent Humphreys, let me start with you. You had to lay off about 20 teachers because of the lack of school funding. I read headlines saying your district was in danger of closing under the old formula. Is that an accurate way to describe how the lack of a new funding formula has affected your district?
It is accurate. We the talk of closing was under whether or not we would have a school funding formula at all this past fall. Many school districts shoot for 90 days cash on hand, and we are well below 90 days cash on hand because of proration and what it's done to public schools since 2009.
And so where do you guys stand now in terms of cash on hand for your district? This is, by the way, School District 37 in East Moline.
Yeah, we're extremely low of cash on hand. I was there when the legislature came to their bipartisan agreement, and we celebrated that day. We thought we had a real change that was going to affect kids across the state of Illinois for a generation or two. And unfortunately, we haven't received any new funding from the state after it was passed that day. We finally, on December 28th, received our last two payments that were due from last year. We have not received any new mandated categorical funding this year, and we have not received any new state money that was appropriated, that $350 million that went out to the state's neediest schools. East Moline would have been one of the biggest. We had one of the most inequitable funding for our school district from the state out of many. I mean, $436 more per student is what we were projected to receive because of how the formula was affecting our school district.
And can you describe what type of students you serve in East Moline?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got amazing families and kids that about 2,800 students, elementary district. Almost 25% of our students do speak a second language in the home. We are approximately 98% free and reduced. So we've got some students with some needs that do take sometimes more funding to be able to help lift up and prepare them for, you know, the world of tomorrow. So that's what we're working on.
That's Superintendent Kristen Humphreys. Heather, I want to bring you in here. You are with the Urban Prairie Waldorf School. That's in Chicago. How your private school, what can you tell us about your school and how the tax credit would help you all?
Sure. First, thank you for having me. So our school is a Waldorf school, like you mentioned, and that means that we work in lots of arts like woodworking and painting and blacksmithing, seamlessly integrating into our core curriculum to engage children's hearts and hands and minds. We are interested in this program because for us it could mean broader economic diversity amongst our student body. We want to serve more students, but just like every other school, we have wages and bills to pay, and we can only offer a certain amount of our budget in tuition assistance. So our thought was that this program could mean that we could offer what we consider to be an important education option to more students.
Heather, from what you've been hearing from Senator Menar and Superintendent Humphreys, are you concerned that the effort to get this tax credit might hold up all of the new and more equitable funding for public schools throughout the state?
We're absolutely concerned about this. No one who really cares about education wants to block access to funding for the students of our state. And I think all schools, public and private, are working really hard every day to serve children. I also agree with Senator Menar when he says that this is a legitimate question that needs to be decided. And that's what we had hoped by seeking clarification from ISBE, that we could better understand how this program could work and if we could be participants, because we're really hoping that all registered schools who want to serve the most needy students in their area are able to with this tax scholarship program.
Superintendent Humphreys, as it stands now, if your district doesn't receive funding from the new formula, what will happen to you all? Where do you go from here?
It would probably blow a $1.2 million hole in our budget, Ayala, and unfortunately, we don't have the funds to cover that. We would probably look at more borrowing just to continue to pay the bills through June 30th. And we've got to look at some situations where, you know, our fund balance was, we're talking a $33 million budget, Nyala, in East Moline. Our fund balance we were projecting was $100,000 to the good if we had received the new state funding this year. So it's a big concern. And unfortunately, in public education, you can't just let go of staff in the middle of the year. So about 98% of our money is already, you know, is going to be spent the way it has to be. So there's not a lot of wiggle room to make cuts at this point for this fiscal year. We're very concerned that this money will not come this year. And, you know, we're hopeful that something will get figured out because this is just another, you know, really it's a punch to the gut of kids across Illinois. You know, they promised to, the state really looked at all kids, not just kids in affluent communities, but all kids, and said, you know, this is our promise to you. We want to lift everyone up. And right now, this is more of the same for East Moline schools and other districts across the state.
Superintendent Humphreys, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. He's superintendent of East Moline School District 37. I want to thank Heather Burhalter as well. She's with the Urban Prairie Waldorf School, a private school in Chicago. Both of you, thanks for being with me, explaining a little bit more on this issue.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For most of us, January means New Year's resolutions, going back to school. But if you work in the gadget industry, January means a trip to Vegas. More than 4,000 companies are currently at the Consumer Electronics Show, hoping to get noticed for their innovative products and designs, whether that would be a smartphone or a smart toilet. Illinois is well represented. We've asked representatives from three Illinois companies to step away from the conference floor to give us a sense of how it's going for their companies. Douglas Krohn is the CEO of the 3D tech firm Dynamism. Tim Ryan is the chief marketing officer for the Chicago startup Moto Bag, which has created a motorized carry-on suitcase. And Stacey Thompson is one of the founders of OV Smarterware, which they bill as the world's first smart food storage system. All three of them are on the line with me now from Vegas. Hey, guys, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, morning.
Hi.
Good morning. Douglas, let's start with you as the veteran of the bunch. How many years has Dynamism been attending CES?
Well, we've been coming for about 15 years in a different capacity, but this is our first year to have a large exhibit on the main show floor.
And so I imagine 3D printing, I feel like, is almost a part of lots of people's lives kind of on a daily basis, whether they go to the library or people who are involved in the Maker Lab movement. How do you distinguish yourself at a show like CES from other 3D tech firms?
Sure. So if you think about a show like CES and just like the other guests on the panel here, everybody's making new products and they're innovating and creating new solutions. And when you make new products, people prototype. So all the companies at CES are 3D printer users because they're all prototyping new products. So we differentiate by having the best selection of different technologies at different price points for them.
And getting to the main floor, how significant is that? Why is it important for your company to have a presence at CES every year?
I think getting to the main floor is where we find it's, you know, it's a much larger undertaking, but it's where we find so many of the industrial clients, automotive clients that are big 3D printer customers that will buy 3D printing solutions from us. So almost all the automakers are there and a lot of the other big product manufacturing companies.
Tim, you're from Moto Bag. Is this your first CES conference? How many have you been to?
It is not my first CES. We're not a CES warrior like our colleague there on the panel, but we were at Moto Bag, we were here at CES 2017 as a prototype. He was just talking about prototypes. We are back this year in production. So there are several different exhibit spaces at CES. We're in what's called the Eureka Park area, which is where a lot of the new innovative ideas are coming from. Many of them are startups or one-year-old startups like Moto Bag is. So this is our second show. It's great. I mean, this is, you know, if you are in technology, this is where the makers and influencers and consumers of IT and innovation meet for a week. So, you know, that's why Las Vegas is at the center of our universe.
Stacey, I wonder if you can give us a sense of what CES is like. How many people are there? As you know, we've heard Douglas and Tim talking about the sort of the tastemakers and how it's sort of also a place to meet very important people in the industry. How many people go to these sorts of things?
I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of people that are here at CES right now. And I mean, we're in Eureka Park as well. And it is swamped all the time. There's four of us that are manning our booth and we're talking constantly, which is really just an amazing, amazing turnout.
And what's it, can maybe you can explain to us how important this is for your business, for Smarterware. Maybe you can explain what Smarterware is about and why it's important for you all to have a presence at CES.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Smarterware is a really a solution to a problem that all Americans have, and that's why we're so excited to be here. If you're like most Americans, you throw away 40% of the food that you bring home, which is just a staggering statistic, and it's not something that we normally take to heart, but, you know, you feel bad when you toss your food in the garbage when you're clearing it out, clearing out your fridge every week, every other week. And what this does is this helps you to remember your food before it actually goes bad. So it's a series of smart tags. Containers, straps, and bands, and, you know, universal connector for you to put on basically anything, your to-go containers. And what it does is that you push a button. You can actually integrate with your voice assistant, say, hey, Alexa, tell Ovi this is spaghetti and meatballs, and it's the leftover you're saving, and she will track that for you for say, 4 days. You're in control of that amount of time. And then after a couple of days, there's a light indicator on your actual storage. That smart tag lights up. in your fridge, so anybody that's actually in your household can see it. That's yellow. It's basically a visual indicator that, hey, this thing is going bad in my fridge. I need to prioritize eating that. And you're going to get a notification on your app as well, right on your phone, that says, hey, don't forget about this thing, and say that's raw ingredients. We also offer up recipe suggestions based on the foods you're tracking. So at any point, we're just trying to help mitigate that issue and that pain point in people's lives where you just, you know, you're just wasting a lot of money per year. So for us, it's a brand new idea that really nobody is tackling this solution. There's smart fridges that are going for around $4,000, and they're amazing, but that's just not accessible for the average American. And so this is a solution that basically makes any fridge a smart fridge.
That's Stacy Thompson. So, yeah, she's the co-founder of OV Smarterware. Tim, you're with Motobag. I have to say, our staff was very entertained watching the videos of your on your website of people sitting on their Motobag, zipping around O'Hare. Can you explain the idea behind the Motobag?
I can. So if OV is in the smartware space, we're in what's called smart luggage. You know, there's a smart in every category, it seems. And so we're smart luggage. It's the intersection of travel and technology for us. And what we've done with Motobag is to really kind of set out to change the way the world travels. We've taken the functionality of a typical suitcase, in our case, a carry-on suitcase, and we've added the innovation of personal mobility to create luggage that you can ride. So you can kind of picture, you know, kind of an old-fashioned wheelie, if you will, the black wheelies that came out in the 70s. So, you know, we kind of think this is the most exciting thing to come to luggage since those first came to the market. So it looks, you know, if you can envision a, you know, a typical carry-on, little black carry-on, ours transforms easily by, you know, kind of setting it down on its side. You unzip a pouch, you pull up a telescoping handlebar, you lock it in place, out come some little foot pegs for your feet. You turn it on, pop your bum on the side of the bag, and give it some gas, and you're off to your next destination, whether that's in an airport setting or whether that's at a convention like CES. Actually, we have some people roaming the halls of CES on their Motobags. It's a great way to get around in this area. Or even what we call urban day trippers. It's great to, you know, as a way to get around in a fun and functional way. Maybe it's along the Chicago lakefront or through the parks, something like that. So you can travel at speed of 5 miles per hour indoor, 8 miles per hour outdoor. It's, you know, it's the only thing that's currently like it in the smart luggage space. There's a lot of smart luggage options. Ours is the only one currently that you can ride.
That's Motobag. Douglas Crone with Dynamism. Can I ask you guys, and I want to, Douglas, let's start with you. There was a power outage that was reported at CES on Wednesday. Were you there for that?
That was actually in the North Exhibit Hall where we exhibit. I think for listeners to get a sense of what the cadence of being at CES is like, everyone who's been to Vegas has probably seen there are a lot of people in Vegas all the time and there's a lot happening. But CES breaks Vegas. the taxis,
wow, that's a great way to describe it.
Everything is completely overwhelmed by the number, the cell phone towers. The cell phones are, it's just over, it's an overwhelming number of people trying to access the infrastructure at one time. So, you know, whether, like they're in the, maybe they're in Eureka Hall and we're in the North Hall and it's not that far, but maybe it takes 40 minutes somehow to get between the two because we can't get taxis and things like that. So there is a power outage for, I think, maybe an hour and the North Hall was shut down. But it's back to normal. But I would say those kinds of things are the kind of normal at CES.
Douglas, can I ask you what it's like to be a Midwestern company, a company from Illinois at CES? Is it important for, I wonder how many other companies you see throughout Illinois? Do you think being in the Midwest and being in tech, it's even more important to have a presence at CES because you don't necessarily have access to folks who might be on the West Coast in funding and capital?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, Chicago area companies are overlooked. There are a lot of great technology companies and a lot of startup. There's a lot of startup activity in Chicago, which people outside don't think about that much, but that's the case. And so I think for really anyone that's not a Silicon Valley company, coming and maybe New York company coming here to a place where all the media, all the tech media and a lot of tech investors are gathered for a week makes it easy to access things that you know, you can access regularly, but you have to get on a plane, and or you have to get on a plane to a bunch of other places. And in this case, everybody's here for a week, so it's very convenient.
Stacey, you're in the middle of a crowdfunding campaign right now for OVI, right? How's that going?
We're actually about to start our crowdfunding campaign at the end of February, early March. And so it will be going wonderfully, hopefully, in the next month or so.
And I wanted to ask you as well, Stacey, about being a woman at CES. The founder of the Consumer Technology Association said that they were committed to changing the status quo and that they would, quote, redouble efforts to expand women's voices throughout the conference and as featured speakers at next year's CES. Is that something you've noticed is lacking?
You know, this being my first year here, it's, you know, you look around and we're less than a quarter probably of the population here, which is
women are, you mean?
Necessarily surprising. Women are, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes. Not Chicago companies. Well, that too. But yeah, there are some efforts being made in order to do that. There was a women's lounge that was put on where there's some fantastic speakers. There's tech makers, women in tech makers. Google's putting one on. I'm going to it tonight. So there are a lot of concerted efforts being made that are really apparent to me just as, you know, a newbie coming into this space. So while it has come from that place, I do believe that there are some inroads into equalizing just that the gender presence here.
Last question for all of you. Tim, let's start with you. I wonder about your preparation for CES and also sort of how you get the most out of it. Is it like every conference? I feel like most conferences, the most valuable thing is often the parties and the networking that happens apart from the conference. Is that the same thing true for a CES, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, any, you know, trade show or exposition, you know, in the margins of that, there's always going to be a lot of networking opportunities, social events that happen, you know, either pre or post event. And that's always going to be useful. I mean, it certainly, I mean, we are kind of in a little bit of a unique spot because, again, our product is so visually different from what you see. It's not every day you see someone riding their suitcase, you know, down a hallway or down an exhibit floor. So, you know, we turn heads just by, you know, demonstrating our product, which is a great benefit for us. So we benefit from, you know, the time really we step onto the show floor and in our booth because our product is so visually different. And we encourage people to demo it. It really is the only way to, you know, to see what it's like. It's great for us. And from a media perspective, you know, the other my colleague on the panel talked about the world media here. That's great for us as well. I mean, we've been fortunate to get a decent media following thus far. And, you know, we have a lot of media coming to us instead of us always having to go to them, which is a nice change of pace.
Yeah, we just have a minute or two left. Douglas, what's kind of your company's goal of what you hope to get out of CES?
So we're a little bit different in that probably who we're looking to meet the most at CES are the other exhibitors who are doing a prototyping of new products and manufacturing. And those prototyping and manufacturing are two industries that buy a lot of 3D printers. And so for instance, we're here exhibiting a very new technology that won actually yesterday, won the Best of CES Tech Innovation Award, which is a metal 3D printer. So we hope to maybe find customers that are doing metal prototyping or want to make custom tools in the factories using our metal 3D printer that we're selling.
Stacey, what about you?
Well, we're really trying to connect and get our word out. Really speaking to press is huge for us. Getting in front of people who are in this area. We've had amazing people stopping by from retailers to manufacturers to potential partners. And so we're really trying to make as many connections as we can and get the word out so that when we go to crowdfunding, we've got that swell that we need in order to get us funded.
That's Stacey Thompson, co-founder of OVI Smarterware. I want to thank Tim Ryan with Motobag, Ride On. He's a chief marketing officer. And Douglas Krohn, CEO of Dynamism. Three Chicago companies represented at CES, the big consumer electronics show, as you can hear them in the background from the floor in Vegas. Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be Chicagoan Bill Ayers is going to be joining us. He's an activist, educator, and writer. Next week, we're going to be talking about ways people save money this January. What are your tips for how you get your finances in order? You can email us at talk@21stshow.org or give us a call. Our hotline number is 217-300-2121. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.